Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Back in 1955, Allen Ginsberg, then an unpublished 29-year-old poet, delivered his poem Howl before a raucous, live audience in a garage-turned-art gallery. That six-gallery reading, with Jack Kerouac pounding a wine jug, shouting, "Go!" is now considered the birth of the Beat Generation. Here's Ginsberg just 4 months later reading those first electrifying lines of Howl.
I saw the best minds of my generation destroyed by madness, starving, hysterical, naked, dragging themselves through the Negro streets at dawn looking for an angry fix.
A new film, Howl, starring James Franco as Allen Ginsberg, tells the story of the epic Beat Generation breakout and poem and of free speech on trial. This hour on Point, we'll talk with the directors of Howl. You can join the conversation. When did you first read Howl? Did it shock you, touch you, free you? You can also comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Let's go right on into the film. Just coming out is Howl. Here's James Franco portraying 29-year-old Allen Ginsberg delivering the first reading of Howl. Here's Franco with the opening lines.
I saw the best minds of my generation destroyed by madness, starving, hysterical, naked, dragging themselves through the Negro streets at dawn looking for an angry fix. Angel-headed hipsters burning for the ancient heavenly connection to the starry dynamo and the machinery of night, who poverty and tatters and hollow-eyed and high sat up smoking in the supernatural darkness of cold water flats floating across the tops of cities contemplating jazz.
James Franco portraying Allen Ginsberg in a new film, Howl. Joining me now from San Francisco are Rob Epstein and Jeffrey Friedman, co-directors of Howl. Rob directed the Academy Award-winning documentary The Times of Harvey Milk. They have collaborated on some terrific documentaries, including the Academy Award-winning film Common Threads, Stories from the Quilt and the Celluloid Closet. They co-wrote, directed, and produced the new film, Howl. Rob Epstein, thanks very much for being with us.
Thanks for having us.
And Jeffrey Friedman, welcome to On Point. Thanks very much for being there.
Hi, Tom. Thanks.
What drew you guys to this now?
Well, it actually was a gift that came to us from Allen Ginsberg's estate. Allen's secretary of 20-plus years, Bob Rosenthal, called us out of the blue one day and asked if we would be interested in doing what he then thought would be a commemorative film on Howl for the 50th anniversary. And, of course, we jumped at the opportunity and then spent the next couple of years figuring out how the hell do you make a film out of a poem.
Yeah, and quite a poem, Jeffrey. I mean, and you come to it with a very unique film structure. Describe it for us.
Well, it's hard to describe. It's multifaceted. We really wanted to do something that would be adventurous in a way that would challenge audiences in the way that the poem was challenging. It's got multiple narrative threads. It's Ginsberg himself explaining his creative process, how he got to the point where he could write the poem.
Played by James Franco.
Mm-hmm. It's the first reading of the sixth gallery that you heard the beginning of. It's an animated trip through the poet's mind, imagined by an artist who worked with Ginsberg and collaborated on a book of poems. And it's the obscenity trial that occurred when the poem was published, where people are trying to understand what this means and is it obscene and what, you know, are there limits to what artists should be free to express? And there are flashbacks to earlier episodes in Ginsberg's life that fed into the the making of the poem.
We learn about a man. We learn about an era. We learn about constitutional and jurisprudence issues around free speech, very big ones. And above all, some will learn and some will revisit Howell himself. Here's another bit of James Franco, again, at the reading, portrayed as a first reading here in the movie. This is from the second part of this very long poem. It's a rant against the industrial world, which Ginsberg kind of describes here as destroying nature, destroying human souls. He even calls out Moloch, the ancient god related to child sacrifice, as a kind of monster beneath it all.
What sphinx of cement and aluminum bashed open their skulls and ate up their brains in imagination? Moloch, solitude, filth, ugliness, ash cans and unobtainable dollars, children screaming under stairways, boys sobbing in armies, old men weeping in the parks. Moloch, Moloch. Nightmare of Moloch, Moloch the loveless, mental Moloch, Moloch the heavy judger of men.
And the hipsters in their bobby socks look on just agog as you portray it. Rob Epstein will have listeners who know this poem inside and out and have known it for a long time. We'll have others who may never have read a word of it. Describe the poem Howl for us.
Describe the poem Howl?
Yeah.
Okay, well, first of all, the poem in its entirety takes about 25 minutes to read.
Yes.
So I'll try not to take that long.
I don't mean a blow by blow, but yeah.
Well, it's structured in four parts. Mm-hmm. And the first part of Howl is very much Alan writing about his own experiences with the people in his lives who were going through great adventures and great adversity, from these mad road trips to being institutionalized in insane asylum. So it's really his howl about everything that he and his generation of friends were experiencing in that moment. And the second part of Howl is all about Moloch, that section we just heard, mm-hmm. which is a cry against the military-industrial complex. And it was really kind of a prescient harbinger of where he predicted things were heading in terms of corporate takeover of so many aspects of our lives. And the third part of Howl is focused on his friend Carl Solomon, who is someone he did meet when he was institutionalized. Alan was in a mental institution for 8 months of his life.
Mm-hmm. When he was quite young. Mm-hmm.
He was in his 20s still. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And Carl Solomon was another writer who he befriended in the institution who was undergoing shock therapy. Alan wasn't, but Alan was having to deal with the fact that he was homosexual, and the only way he was able to get out of that mental institution was to claim that he was cured, that he was now heterosexual. And the fourth part of Howl is called the footnote, and it's really the grace note. It's really a beautiful Buddhist meditation about the holiness of everything we know.
We'll come to the grace note, and it is beautiful, but there is a lot of raging and woe and empathy for Carl Solomon, maybe in a way for his mother as well. What he had to sign papers when he was 21, permitting for her lobotomy to take place. She'd been in and out of institutions himself. Here he is in that part three of Howl, again in James Franco's reading, and he's really got that Ginsberg cadence with the part of his tribute to his friend Carl Solomon in the psychiatric hospital.
I'm with you in Rockland, where we wake up electrified out of the coma by our own souls' airplanes roaring over the roofs. They've come to drop angelic bombs. The hospital illuminates itself. Imaginary walls collapse. Oh, skinny legions run outside. Oh, starry-spangled shock of mercy. The eternal war is here. Oh, victory! Forget your underwear. We're free.
James Franco as Allen Ginsberg reciting very early on how Jeffrey Friedman, you know, you read the histories of this, and it is presented that with that reading, the Beat era tore open on that very night. What was the reaction to Howell in that crowd, first of all? Not in the courts, you know, not in the parlors, but in that crowd that night.
You know, from all accounts, it was electric. It was the first time anybody had heard this poem, and this poem was unlike anything they had heard. And poetry readings were something that were also a new phenomenon that were taking place in San Francisco at the time. And the reading of Howell, you know, as performance really was the beginning of what we think of as poetry slams.
Mm-hmm.
And from all accounts, the audience got more and more raucous as the evening went on, and everybody was drunk and they were passing around bottles of wine. But I think they were also intoxicated by the language and excited by hearing something new. Lawrence Ferlinghetti was in the audience, the publisher of City Lights, mm-hmm, books, and the owner of City Lights bookstore, and he heard the poem for the first time that night. And the story that he tells is that he sent a telegram to Ginsberg saying, "I greet you at the beginning of a great career. When do I get the manuscript?"
Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking about Allen Ginsberg's Howl and the new movie Howl that tells the story of the epic Beat Generation poem. Rob Epstein and Jeffrey Friedman, co-writers, directors, and producers of Howl, join us from San Francisco. They went right to court. Ferlinghetti was charged with the charges against him for bringing obscenity out. Publisher was brought to court in 1957. Here's a bit from Rob and Jeffrey's movie, Howl, where Mary Louise Parker as Gail Potter, a radio personality, English teacher, and witness for the prosecution, give a pretty scathing conservative literary critique of Howl on the stand.
In order to have literary style, you must have form, diction, fluidity, clarity. Now, I'm speaking only of style. And in content, every great piece of literature, anything that can really be classified as literature, is of some moral greatness. And I think this fails to the nth degree.
I see. Can you think of any other reasons?
Yes. Use of language. In regards to the figures of speech he uses, he fails in rhetoric, of course, for one thing, because his figures of speech are crude, and you feel like you're going through the gutter when you read that stuff.
Rob Epstein, tell us about the court battle that ensued over this poem.
Well, it was a huge deal in its time. It was a municipal court trial in San Francisco, and the judge, Clayton Horn, was regarded to be a conservative judge. He was a Sunday school teacher. So the outcome wasn't at all predictable at that time. And Ferlinghetti's defense attorney was Jake Ehrlich, who's played by John Hamm in the movie.
Madman.
And he was, exactly, and he was a very popular legal figure in his day, and in fact was the model for the television show Perry Mason.
So he was well known. Was the country following this? Was it just San Francisco following
yes,
this?
Yes, it was very much a national story. If you look at all the periodicals from then, Life magazine had a huge pictorial cover spread of the trial, and it was definitely being followed nationally.
And the outcome, I guess we don't have to keep it a mystery here. I mean, Howl stayed on the shelves.
It did, and it set a precedent. It was often cited in further obscenity trials.
It also put the Beats on the map. I mean, it's really the moment when people became aware of this movement of literary rebels in San Francisco, who were out to change the world.
Give us that history, Jeffrey, of who they were and how tightly they were wound into Allen Ginsberg's circle. Jack Kerouac and Neil Cassidy and right on.
That was the immediate circle in the early years. They met in New York through a mutual friend when Alan was at Columbia. And they just had this real meeting of the minds, and they had this idea of a new vision and creating a new language that would speak in literature and in poetry and in novels in a language that was everyday speech. I mean, that was sort of their breakthrough was that they would create literature that was in the same language that they spoke to one another, and that's also what got Alan in trouble. That's what got the poem in trouble,
because they spoke so very, very, very freely to one another. And Ginsberg, Rob, brought that right into his poetry and his readings and all the rest.
He did. He articulates within the film how finding his authentic voice was how he found himself as an artist, and he credits Jack Kerouac for really leading him to that point. One of the reasons we were so interested in the trial, aside from the fact that it so contextualized the times of the 1950s, which is such a conformist era, and these guys were all about opening up the window to sort of break out and let the air in, as it were. But also just the way in which all of that language and all that attempt at authenticity is reinterpreted and deconstructed within the trial setting itself, which we found just such a fascinating way to look at the poem from the perspective of then.
I thought that was pretty terrific. Stanley Fish goes on today in the New York Times about how you've made literary criticism live off the witness stand in the trial, and that was pretty cool. You also bring Ginsberg to life and his kind of struggles over here. He was as a homosexual trying to, for a time he tried to deny it, tried to, you know, be straight, live straight, had a job at an ad agency, was afraid to bring it out, afraid to live more honestly. Here's James Franco from the new film Howl talking about a breakthrough session with his, shrink psychiatrist who encouraged him to work through that fear and insecurity, to quit his job, pursue poetry full time.
I mean, what will happen if I grow old and stains in my underwear and I'm living in some furnished room and nobody loves me and I'm white-haired and have no money and breadcrumbs are falling on the floor? And he said, don't worry about that. You're very charming and lovable and people will always love you. What a relief to hear that. I very soon realized that it was all a fear trap. Just illusory.
James Franco is Allen Ginsberg talking about escaping the fear trap, and on the back, the wings of his poem, many in this country soon did the same. Let's bring our listeners in. Hannah in Columbia, South Carolina. Hannah, you're on the air.
Hey, hello. I was lucky to turn on my car when I did to hear a little piece of Howl, and I sort of, my chest swelled. I hadn't thought about it or listened to it or anything, you know, with Ginsberg or Neruda sort of since I graduated from college. And I guess it was regarded even then as sort of a dirty liberal secret. You know, you studied it, but you were envious and excited, and gee, I wish I could have such revolutionary thoughts and ideas. I wish I could be a radical and stand up for something. And I was embarrassed that I hadn't thought about it in as long as I had. So I'm excited to hear that this movie's being made. I'm excited that we all get a chance to relive something that was so influential, both as, you know, for liberals, for conservatives, you know, across the board. I'm excited that we all get to sort of throw away our civility and embrace what made Ginsberg and this beatnik generation so amazing.
Hannah, is that energy still out there for you today? Does it seem like a million years ago? What?
Well, you know, that's what got me tickled when I turned the car on this morning. You know, I was minding my own business and driving to work and oh ho hum, And then when I heard just a few passages, I was like, yes, you know, I forgot why it got us so energized in the first place. I forgot why I poured over it, you know, in college and why we studied it and had such a vicarious love for it. I think it's out there. I think there are those of us who are secretly, you know, we secretly want to start our own revolution and have a passion over something. And it's sort of been lost in the mayhem and the pessimism. So I feel like it has given me a fresh breath for the day, even now, to revisit it after all these years.
And I'm so glad for your call. Here, we'll give you a little bit more. This is not from the poem, but from Allen Ginsberg. And I think it's taken, Rob, Jeffrey, I think everything here is from historical record. Are you making up the dialogue here, or is it all things
that were? Every word spoken in the movie is actual documentary text. We wrote the script using all written and spoken word.
Well, here's James Franco then as Allen Ginsberg in his own words talking about the impact of his poem about how he says it's like a promotion of frankness about any subject.
The poem is misinterpreted as a promotion of homosexuality. Actually, it's more like a promotion of frankness about any subject. If you're a foot fetishist, you write about feet. If you're a stock market freak, you can write about the rising sales curve of the Standard Oil chart. Yeah. When a few people are frank about homosexuality in public, it breaks the ice. And then people are free to be frank about anything.
Frank about everything, and the bleepers at work here, because it was very free in its language, and the language was shocking, and it stays still. We cannot hear it. Bill in Burlington, Vermont. Bill, you're on the air.
It sounds more shocking than
yeah,
it is.
I know, and they do. It's kind of crazy. Bill, we tried. Bill, you're on the air.
Hi, yes, thanks for taking my call. I just wanted to contribute one thing. I had the opportunity to, about 40 years ago, I'm 69 or 70, go to a reading that Ginsberg did in Baltimore, and had the opportunity to meet him very briefly after the meeting. And it's hard to imagine, even from the words or from hearing other people talk about him, the emanation of sweetness, of energy, of light and love that came out of the man and shone out of his eyes. In fact, he was just, in the clip you just played, he was talking about his homosexuality. I've read several biographies of Kerouac, in which, of course, Ginsberg figures heavily in. Apparently many straight men who thought they would never have any kind of homosexual experience had affairs with Ginsberg because of this very quality that he had. He was so gentle, so unaffected, so, not really with any hidden agenda, just really a loving, sweet person.
And you felt it, and many did. That comes through in James Franco's portrayal, Rob. Jeffrey, I mean, it's interesting. That flows right through. It's bizarre, but the eyeglasses are all back in style now, so they look very contemporary today.
Yes.
But he doesn't have that full, famously huge Allen Ginsberg beard of later years. It's sort of down in the, I don't know, Johnny Depp length.
No, but it's very much modeled on what Allen looked like at that period. And in fact, in that year, 57, is when he first started to grow a beard. So it really suggests the Ginsberg that we would come to know in his later years. But James does such a great job of capturing all those qualities that the caller just described. He really embodies the spirit of Allen and put a great deal of effort into understanding the kind of depths of his character and his soul. So not only does he do such a wonderful job of really capturing his mannerisms and his vocalisms, but you really get that kind of essential generosity of spirit from his performance as well.
That sweetness and light and love, as our caller says. Let's get a call from San Francisco. Diamond Dave. Diamond Dave, you're on the air.
Yo, I'm right here, too. Hey, what a long, strange trip has been. I got here, in fact, headed from Minneapolis, Minnesota in 1957, having read an article about what was going on here in San Francisco, mentioning that reading in 55 at the Sixth Gallery, mentioning the trial, hitchhiked here, and walked up, had mentioned the article, and had read the poem. I had read the poem in Evergreen Review on my way out, and walked up Grand Avenue to City Lights and stood there, and there in the window was Kenneth Ferlinghetti, was Lawrence Ferlinghetti, putting back in the window. It's a much smaller bookstore then.
Yeah.
Putting back in the window that copies volume one, number one of the Pocket Poet series of Howell, putting it back in the window because he had just been acquitted in that trial, which took place right across the street, right around the corner at the Hall of Injustice, in which it was where Perry Mason, if you remember Perry Mason,
right, sure, yeah,
it
we
always
get...
opened.
The Hall of Injustice, and what did you make of the poem, Diamond Dave?
Well, the poem rocked my socks off because it was the brother before it just called, said it was about reality. It was about a bohemia that had started right after, and had a few handfuls of people right after World War II that had begun to flourish in San Francisco, really after I got there. I had to get there. Kerouac was there. Casti was there. They were working the railway. Ginsberg just came through just after I got there, and his beard was just spouting out with Tosky, with Peter. And I also want to mention, I happen to hear that Eric Drucker, who's an old friend of mine, did the animation.
Yes, he did, and it's something else.
I drove that to add to the movie. I haven't seen the movie yet. I'm looking forward to it.
You're going to enjoy it. You're going to enjoy it, Diamond Dave. We appreciate your call today. Thanks so much from San Francisco. Here's James Franco as Allen Ginsberg talking with an interviewer in the movie Howl about what real, lasting poetry is about.
If it's at all spontaneous, I don't know whether it even makes sense sometimes. And other times, I do know it makes complete sense. I start crying. Because I realize that I'm hitting on an area that's absolutely true. In that sense, able to be read by someone and wept to, maybe centuries later. In that sense, prophecy. Because it touches a common key.
James Franco as Allen Ginsberg talking about poetry, spontaneous and lasting, he hopes. Rob Epstein, you've got a quote from Allen Ginsberg here I see. In the poem that changed America, Howl, 50 years later, he says, in publishing Howl, I was curious to leave behind, after my generation, an emotional time bomb that would continue exploding. Is it? Does it, Rob?
Yeah, and that was really our guiding spirit that really helped direct us to this mission, which was to introduce Allen and the poem and this period to a younger generation. I mean, just going back to some of the previous callers who speak to their own experience with the work from the time, we really also wanted to very much introduce this spirit of Ginsberg and everything that the Beats represent to a younger audience, and we're so glad that's happening.
Jeffrey, Allen Ginsberg lived a long life after Howl. What did he come to think about its effect? You know, had his time bomb worked in his own lifetime, in his eyes?
Think, you know, I think it did. I think Howl certainly put him on the map. I mean, it was when Howl got published that he was able to get On the Road published, Jack Kerouac's novel. He helped get William Burroughs published. But Howl was something that stayed with him throughout his life, and he continued to read it over the years. It sort of became his signature performance piece. And it really influenced, you know, it influenced the culture in a way that I think he really loved, because he participated in a very active way throughout the 60s and 70s and 80s and even 90s. He always kept up with whatever was happening in current culture. You know, in the 80s, he was doing performing in punk clubs in New York.
Yeah. Allen also speaks about prophecy in the movie, as played by
mm-hmm.
James,
mm-hmm.
and the poem has proved to be prophetic in so many ways.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about Allen Ginsberg's Howl, and the new movie Howl that tells the story of the
epic Beat Generation poem. Co-writers, directors, and producers of Hal, Rob Epstein, and Jeffrey Friedman are with us from San Francisco. And it's just great to have them here. James Franco plays Allen Ginsberg in the film, and it's quite something. We're joined as well right now from New York by John Titel, professor of English literature at Queens College, City University of New York. He was a friend of Allen Ginsberg's. He's credited as being one of the first scholars to recognize the significance of the Beat's vision and style in his book Naked Angels, Lives and Literature of the Beat Generation. John Titel, thank you very much for being with us today.
Hi.
You say straight up that you're not big on Hollywood biopics, but you call this film Howl ambitious, valiantly heartfelt, and you know, you're fairly open to its effort to recreate the context here. How about it, John?
Well, I've had some experience because I wrote the first biopic on Jack Kerouac, which was produced by John Antonelli. I know how hard it is to do, and I think these gentlemen have done a brilliant job.
You wrote the screenwriter for Kerouac, the movie. That's high praise.
I did write that.
Yeah,
and I did all the interviews.
It was a great movie.
Well.
And high praise for these guys coming from you. You call Howl the most important long poem written by an American since T.S. Eliot's The Wasteland. Describe that importance for us, John.
Well, first of all, I would say that Helen Vendler at Harvard would agree with that, I suspect.
We just had her on talking about Emily Dickinson, but now you're in another neck of the woods. Yeah, yeah.
And that's fine.
Yeah,
Emily
sure.
Emily Dickinson is a tremendously important poet.
Mm-hmm.
We have two important 19th century poets. One is Dickinson, who was unknown, and the other is Whitman, who was hardly known. And it's interesting to notice that Howl is written exactly a century after Song of Myself, which is Whitman's breakthrough. As a tribute to him, in part, certainly using much of what Ginsberg learned from Whitman.
You know,
I visited Allen a lot, and I was always struck by the portrait of Whitman that he had over his bed.
What broke open in that, handful of years, with this poem, with Kerouac's On the Road? How do you describe what was opening up there, John?
It was like an explosion in the face of a systematic repression that began during the war because of the war, but continued after the war for at least a decade. It really was the perpetuation of the Victorian ethos in America. Some of that had been upset by the trial of Henry Miller's Tropic of Cancer. But this trial got as much publicity and was as important.
Rob Epstein, Walt Whitman, as you depicted in the film, very much came up in the courtroom drama around this poem. I mean, Ginsberg was writing very much, as John Titel says, in tradition very explicitly of Walt Whitman, but doing so to put a stick of dynamite kind of into the culture of his own time, Rob.
Yes, and very much writing about his own time. But he often spoke of Whitman being an important influence in his life.
How do you gauge the impact forward, John Titel, of this poem? I mean, did Ginsberg have any sense of what was coming in the rush? I mean, we had the 60s.
No, this was written as a private thing. This was not even written for publication.
Mm-hmm.
And it was self-published initially on Mimeograph. It's only Ferlinghetti who saw the possibilities. Ferlinghetti is a very interesting figure. Started Hoodie Lights with the idea of freedom of expression.
Mm-hmm.
And when he writes to Ginsberg the next day, he's paraphrasing Emerson's letter to Whitman. I greet you at the beginning of a great career.
Right.
It was more Jeffrey Friedman than a career for Allen Ginsberg, though. It was an era for this country, in many ways, the world cracking open there.
It changed the world. The poem helped change the world. I mean, there were a lot of other things
on
the bandwagon, like rock and roll. But the poem made an enormous contribution to that social change, that cultural change. And I remember talking to William Burroughs 30 years ago, and he said that for him, the greatest significance of the Beat Generation was cultural rather than literary. I disagree with that. I think they're both very significant.
Jeffrey Friedman, you mentioned slam poetry earlier, and you can certainly hear this guy's version of slam poetry at work. But, you know, it's hard to even imagine rock and roll without Howell. I mean, somehow the cadence and freedom that Ginsberg brought forward seems to absolutely be blown up in rock and roll.
Yes, and they fed off each other. I mean, Alan was really listening to a lot of bebop and Charlie Parker. He was very influenced by the whole notion of jazz as improvisation, creativity as improvisation, and that was very much a part of his his method. Although he refined it, but his initial burst of expression is very spontaneous, and I think that's something that Kerouac and he valued greatly, this idea of expressing freely something that's essentially true.
Our listeners are responding to that. Dick in Somerville, Massachusetts, you're on the air, Dick.
Hello, Tom, and your guests. I just wanted to say I was a junior in college in 1958 when I first read Howell. I was an English major, but it completely turned around my understanding of literature and poetry. I became a poet. I'm still a poet. 1966, I started a magazine with a couple other guys that is still going, Literary Magazine, and, you know, it's really because of Allen Ginsberg and Howell and the Beat Generation. I'm sort of the next generation after the Beats, but it's quite true what your guests have been saying. That's really what broke it all open.
Dick, give us your name if you're still writing. We want to know.
Dick Lurie, L-O-U-R-I-E.
And
still writing, yeah.
And inspired then and writing now, right from the voice of that generation or right behind it. Let's get a younger one maybe. Stephen in Windham, Connecticut. Stephen, you're on the air.
Hi, I think Hal's I agree with the professor. I was born in 66, but I think this changed the world. I agree it's a layer of things that changed the world.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't think you could get like Lou Reed's Velvet Underground without Hal. And a lot of these other bands where you have like a freer, kind King Light of Mind style of writing. So you can see it's clear delineation between it's true what they're saying. It's like an Emily Dickinson generation, and then there's the Hal generation, and afterwards it's a big dividing line.
Stephen, I love it, and let's keep it right on going. Cooksville, Tennessee. Patrick, you're on the air.
Yeah. Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I think that Howell is still very pertinent today, as well as the entire movement, just going back to what you were asking about before. And in college, I went to school in Lowell, the birthplace of Jack Kerouac.
Yeah,
and
Massachusetts,
my
yeah.
friends and I, we all idolized the Beats, and inspired by the Beats, we actually started our own poetry group in which we would often sit around campfires on weekends reading poetry to each other and playing music, and at one point ended up in the police log for Andover, Massachusetts for having a campfire at the quarries, which we were very proud of. We felt very rebellious.
you can still hear it living right on today. I want to get a sense of how in the new movie, and thank you, Patrick, for your call, how these issues of what can be said and what is freedom when it comes to speech get laid out with the poem woven right through. Here's a bit from the film Howl, where James Franco, as Allen Ginsberg, is reading from the poem Howl. The poem's describing Ginsberg's friend Neil Cassady, for whom he uses a profane term for a very active ladies' man.
Neil Cassady, secret hero of this poem, an Adonis of Denver, joy to the memory of his innumerable lays of girls in empty lots and diner backyards, movie houses, rickety rows, on mountaintops, in caves, or with gaunt waitresses and familiar roadside lonely petticoat uplifting, and especially secret gas station solipsisms of John's and hometown alleys, too.
So there's James Franco reading from Howl in the depicted first real public reading there in the movie Howl. Then we cut right, we're quickly back in the courtroom, and here's John Hamm, famous from Mad Men, as defense attorney Jake Ehrlich, asking the court whether Howl would be shocking to the public if it had conformed not to that kind of in-the-street-and-back-alley venue, but to upper-class expectations.
I suppose he could have said that the secret hero of these poems, this man, this Adonis of Denver, joy to the memory of his innumerable conquests at the Waldorf Astoria, or at dinner at Chasen's, or after one or two drinks in going to bed at the Stork Club. But that isn't the kind of person he is writing about. It is not for us to choose the words. Mr. Ginsburg, in telling his story, is telling the story as he sees it. He is using his words.
Very, very free words, and the film quite wonderfully takes us right into the conclusion where, you know, the judge is looking at this and trying to figure out what to do. It was the People versus Ferlinghetti. The judge, as Rob Epstein and Jeffrey Friedman says, a conservative, a Sunday school teacher, initially considered a major obstacle to the defense, but he came around in the end. Here's Bob Balaban portraying Judge Clayton Horn in the final ruling in the movie.
There are a number of words used in Howl that are presently considered coarse and vulgar in some circles of the community, and in other circles such words are in everyday use. The author of Howl has used those words because he believed that his portrayal required them as being in character. The people state that such words are not necessary and that others would be more palatable. The answer is that life is not encased in one formula whereby everyone acts the same and conforms to a particular pattern. Would there be any freedoms of press or speech if one must reduce his vocabulary to vapid, innocuous euphemism?
Life is not encased in one formula, and with that ruling, it would not be akin. There from the movie Howl. Colin in Hartford, Connecticut, you're on with Rob Epstein, Jeffrey Friedman, and John Titel.
Hey, I can't wait to see this film. I'm a photographer and an artist, and I first got turned on to Howl in the 80s when I was in college. And I love how things are turning back to the 80s and also to the early to mid-60s, and I just love all this throwback stuff. I would not have become an artist or photographer if it weren't for Howl. I think the connections between the beat poets and Robert Frank, the photographer, is actually what sort of came together and influenced me a great deal in the early to mid-80s, and I'm still at it, and I'm just real excited that a whole new generation is going to get turned on to all of this stuff, and hopefully it'll inspire a whole new crop of artists, and I can't wait to see it. I think I saw some of the clips on YouTube, and it just looks really interesting. It's not just the story, but the art direction looked great.
Yeah, it's really something.
Thank you. Actually, Robert Frank was a big influence in the style of the film, especially the film Pull My Daisy, very much informed a lot of the framing and the whole style of the flashbacks.
John Titel, what's your assessment of the freedom that Allen Ginsberg was reaching for in Howl? Is it still out there? Do we take it for granted now? Has it receded? What?
Well, freedom can never be taken for granted. We start with
that.
Well,
it can be, but you lose it in a hurry, I guess, if you do.
I'd like to make a point about the language. The language is not only about freedom. It's brilliantly inventive. When he creates images like hydrogen jukebox, or angelical bombs.
Yeah.
There's such an element
in
of
the A-bomb era. Yeah.
Those juxtapositions.
Yeah.
That any reader wakes up and slows down in order to read the line more carefully. And this goes all through the poem. And this is a poet rather than someone who's arguing primarily for free speech. Allen took that for granted. This was something he wrote for himself.
He was free, and in the reading, in the movie, takes it right to the holy, as James Franco reads here.
Holy, 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 holy. The world is holy. The soul is holy. The skin is holy. The nose is holy.
James Franco at the conclusion of the reading depicted in the new film Howl. Rob Osteen, what do you hope viewers of your movie with Jeffrey Friedman will take away from Howl this time?
Well, there's so many things we hope they'll take away from it. Certainly inspired by the life of this incredible artist and the humanity that he brought to his work and to his life in general.
And Jeffrey, your hope for how it resonates in the year 2010?
You know, I hope it'll kindle some of that rebellious spirit, and I hope it'll inspire people to act not out of fear, but out of love and joy.
John Titel, does it still have that power?
Absolutely. I mean, I introduce a couple of hundred students every year to Howl, and I find so many of them responding so powerfully.
It's all in the movie, and it is headed for you. John Titel at the City University of New York, Queens College. Thank you very much for being with us today, John.
HowlTheMovie.com.
HowlTheMovie.com. Rob Epstein, co-writer, director, and producer of Howl. Thank you for joining us, Rob.
Thanks for having us.
And Jeffrey Friedman, also co-writer, director, and producer. Thank you so much for being with us.
It's a pleasure. Thanks.
We will go out with the words of Allen Ginsberg himself singing Father Death Blues. Listeners, thanks for joining us. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
To sing this blues. Buddha Death, I wake with you. Dharma Death, your mind is new. Sangha Death, we'll work it through. Suffering is what was born. Ignorance made me forlorn. Tearful truths I cannot scorn. Father breath, once more, farewell. Birth you gave was no thing ill. My heart is still, as time will tell.